Welcome to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Marcellaro, and this week my guest is Jean McDonald. You may know her from Smile Software and nowadays, App Camp for Girls. Jean, good afternoon. Thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. Good afternoon to you.
I think I first got to know you or be aware of you back in the Mac World San Francisco days when you were with Smile.
Yes. And the good old days.
Yes, the good old days. At the Thirsty Bear and all sorts of parties and stuff like that. Yeah, yeah.
Yes, I believe we're all a little bit party, have a party deficit disorder now with Macworld being no longer, Macworld Expo going away.
Yeah, I think there's some sort of side events. There's a feeling in the community that there was and is, continues to be a strong community of people, developers, writers, people who are involved in the Apple world who really need to get together. And they do that anyway in some of these other events. I forget the name of them. Do you remember what it is?
I know one thing that happened this year was called MacStock Expo in the Chicago area. And I was supposed to be there, but I unfortunately got sick right beforehand. And I have been to several developer-oriented conferences like CocoaConf and CocoaLove and Release Notes, which are great conferences. But Macworld is different from that. And it's, was users, as you say, users and developers and writers and fans. And it was just a different combination of people with a different purpose than, say, a strictly, developer-oriented meetup.
Yeah, when people get together like that, they hatch plans, they work on business agreements, meeting face-to-face, they get to talk and get to know people that they've been doing business with or want to work with in the future. I mean, it's just a great community to be a part of.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I know you from Smile, but I wanted to hear a little bit about how you got there. And we were talking in the pre-show about your background. And I'm very intrigued by this Russian history thing. I want to know more about that.
yes. As I said, it's an important step to go into app marketing is to first get your graduate degree in Russian history.
I know. Well, I'm kind of in the same boat. I worked on a PhD too in astrophysics, and my career took a turn. And so these events that happen in your life, all kind of, you smile and you look back and you go, this is what launched me, or this is what diverted me, or I went running away from this or screaming or towards that.
Yes. And I do get, kind of sad when people talk about, we need to get rid of these departments in universities that don't lead to, specific professions, because most of the people out there are working with a degree in something that probably was not what they're doing today.
But often that degree gives you skills and perspective that sort of stoke the fires of your creativity later on.
Exactly. And so for me, I was an undergrad in Russian history as well at the University of North Carolina. And then that's right when PCs were, I knew somebody getting an IBM PC when I was a senior in college. So it was a pretty big exotic deal that I wasn't really part of. But I had learned how to do word processing on a mainframe computer. Anyway, that was my first really big computer work was word processing. I always wanted to go to graduate school. I really envisioned myself as a college teacher. And I enjoyed graduate school quite a bit, despite how it can be very brutal, as you know. it's a lot of hard work, and it's not very confidence building. They are really there to it's kind of a hazing, a little bit, make sure you're really serious about the subject matter, which apparently I was not. I mean, I really like Russian history, but I was much more interested in working with students, not with books. And so I left the program and went to So I was in graduate school at Princeton University in New Jersey, and I went to New York City because I was really interested in book publishing. And
did you learn Russian along the way as part of Russian history?
Yes, yes.
Do you still speak it very well?
Not very well. I can read it, and I know, you know, I mean, I have a pretty big vocabulary in Russian because, of course, when you do history, you spend a lot of time in the archives reading historical documents. And so I know a lot of esoteric vocabulary from the Russian late 19th century, early 20th century Russian political, philosophical, psychological circles. I was interested in intellectuals at that time. And so, but speaking it, no, I was never even a fluent Russian speaker because I never spent time more. I was in the Soviet Union, as it was known back then, for a week on a tourist trip. But I never got to go there and do research, say, for a whole year, and when I would get really good.
Yeah, that's what language students do. They spend a year in a native country, and boy, you really get to know the language after that.
Yeah, it really makes a big difference. I
always wanted to learn Russian.
It's a beautiful language, and the alphabet is beautiful, I think. Just, you know, visually, it's cool to look at. And Slavic languages are interesting. If you've only studied Romance or even Germanic languages, it's a whole new set of roots and structures. And Russian is quite complicated compared to, say, you know, French or even German, because it has six cases. So German only has four. I don't even know what we call it in English, but there's many endings you have to memorize. The Defense Department has a language institute in Monterey, California.
I've heard of that.
And my father was actually there in the 50s. He studied Russian, which is how I got interested in it. And so I know that that institute, you know, the amount of time you spend there depends on the language that you choose. And Russian is at the level three, where you have to be there for like 2 or 3 years, versus Spanish, you only have to be there for one. And I think the only languages above Russian are Chinese and Arabic. So German is like a level two. Anyway, it's the cool thing, though, about studying Russian history, I don't know, cool. It was cool to me because I am interested in languages, is that you also had to pass an exam in German and French, because Russian history is quite intertwined with German and French history as well. And so to read original documents, you had to be able to do those languages. And of course, I did actually go to Germany for a year, and I spent a good deal of time in France. And those two languages, I feel quite more confident than Russian. I don't know. I have mixed feelings. I'd like to go to Russia, but Russia seems so messed up right now that I just can't. And it was messed up back then.
Those are the languages that I studied. I started learning German when I was 14 and took 4 years of high school German, got into the point where I could read Schrift. Mm-hmm. And then took some college German, and it was great. I loved it. And then I got to go to Germany when my wife and I were working at White Sands Missile Range years later. She was going to Germany on business, doing research on M1 tanks in Germany for the Army. And I got to go over there and was sitting in the city circle in Darmstadt one day having lunch. My wife was off on a mission, and I got to chat with a doctor, and I was using my German, and I thought, wow, this is cool. This is awesome. But over the years, I've lost my vocabulary, and my French is even worse, but it's an amazing experience. Everybody should learn another language, by the way, and travel in another country. It's just so eye-opening.
Yes, absolutely.
So fast forward, how did you get from graduate school in Russian history to Smile Software, or were there other detours along the way you want to talk about?
There, not too many detours after that. I worked in book publishing in New York City, and I worked primarily in foreign rights. So my job was to get foreign publishers to translate and publish the authors that I was representing. And that was really cool. I got to go to the Frankfurt Book Fair, which was kind of my goal. And then I left New York and moved to Portland, Oregon. My family had all kind of moved here over the years. We all like Portland a lot. And my sister, who was a product marketing manager at Hewlett-Packard, had started a software company for doing, it was arts and crafts software, multimedia software for kids in the 90s.
Isn't that Corvallis nearby?
Hewlett-Packard, I mean, there is a Hewlett-Packard in Corvallis, but near Portland, it's in actually Vancouver, Washington. It's called the Vancouver Division.
Oh, I've been there.
Apple there's a lot
their,
of...
their FileMaker office there.
Oh,
in
really?
Vancouver, yeah.
Ah, yeah. So my sister had this company, and I was doing localization for them. And I actually was living in Paris and working with the localization team there, and in Strasbourg is where we did the German localization. And so I got my taste of working with software. And during that time, I was also, you know, it was a startup. Like, one of my jobs was internet marketing, which was 1995, so, you know, not very well-developed field. And I was trying to figure out how to get our website updated. And the programmers at our company said to me, here, you could learn how to do that yourself, i.e., we don't want to do that. It's not really, we know it's technically on our list of things we're supposed to be doing, but you could learn this. And of course, I'm into that. You know, like I said, I was a word processing fiend in the 80s. I learned everything about word processing back then. And so, yeah, to me, like doing HTML and...
That's the next step,
actually,
right?
Yep. There was a program called Claris Homepage.
And oh, I've used that. Oh, I've used that. It was awesome. CHP.
Yeah, I mean, it was. And so I did that, and I still didn't understand how the web worked. I didn't know how to get the pages on the website, for example. I could design them, but I didn't know how to get them up there. And again, the programmers at our company were like, yeah, we can't really help you with that for another 2 weeks, right?
So I bet you learned FTP in a hurry.
Well, that's what I was like, what is this FTP? I don't understand, like, can I take a class in that, right? Because I know, it's very amusing in hindsight. So I did take a class in, I did an intensive web design class at the art college here in Portland, and had an awesome teacher, a super Intuit Mac guy, and very, you know, just a friendly guy who became one of my best friends. And on that last day of that class, he said, okay, we're going to upload the websites. And we fire up Fetch, and, you know, it's basically drag and drop. And I said, that's it? That's all that you have to do to get the web pages up on the site? So, yeah.
Well, yeah, you do have to put it in the right directory.
So but. Developers, you know, I have a jaundiced eye towards them now. When they tell me they can't do things, I know what they really mean.
So that's an interesting cycle in itself, going from Russian history to book publishing with foreign publishers to the web to doing what you were doing with Smile.
Yeah. Well, I was a freelance web designer. So after I left the company my sister started, I really liked web design, and I thought, you know, and I was good at it, and I liked the technical aspects of it, and I was ready to give marketing a rest. And so I just focused on web design for a number of years, and Smile was one of my clients.
Aha.
So that is how I ended up with Smile.
Connect the dots.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Well, we're going to have to take a short commercial break right now, Jean. When we return, I want to ask you about App Camp for Girls and the CBS Innovation Nation. Folks, we will be right back after this word.
Hello there, all you fabulous background mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
And we are back. Thank you, Kelly. So now I want to talk about App Camp for Girls, because this is something that you've created. And I've been kind of like an observer from a distance of this for a long time. And mm-hmm. I know that our Kelly has been working with you, Kelly Gamont, as one of the, instructors or mentor or what?
I call her the camp cheerleader, but yes, she's got a lot of energy, a lot of super positive energy. And so, you know, a lot of people in technology, our volunteers are no exception, are on the quiet side, maybe the introverted side. Mm-hmm. And then we have Kelly. And we need a Kelly to get the girls revved up and moving during the day and staying on schedule. And of course, she does help out with all the mentoring, as you say, of the girls to learn how to become app developers and geeks in general. She's a great geek guide.
Yes, she is. Well, this all started when you were at WWDC,
yes.
Right? When you looked around. I've had that experience too. I went to 18 straight WWDCs starting in the mid-90s. And one of the things we all did was we looked around and we counted the women who were present. Yeah. And it was something on the order of, we estimated 1 in 100, 2 in 100, something like that.
Yeah, I think that's right. There's no official figures, but I heard that was like 250 out of 5,000, you know, the recent WWDCs, mm-hmm. Or at least the one that I was at, where I was feeling like, wow, this is kind of crazy that there's so few. I expected it to be male-dominated. I mean, I knew that. I knew that I worked in a male-dominated field, but it's so different from Macworld Expo, which is, so for years I went to Macworld Expo and worked, you know, up with Smile, with Philip and Greg there at Smile, doing the trade show. That's how I got started, actually. That was the first thing, is they asked me to come and help them, because Philip was my friend, and we were neighbors and we were good friends. And he said, would you like to come down to San Francisco and help us at the booth? And I'm like, sure. Like, you know, didn't really know what I was getting into. And I was so impressed with the crowd at Macworld Expo, how it was not just a bunch of young, geeky boys. It was everybody, you know, and there were a lot of women there and a lot of families and grandmas, you know, like the age. There was an age range there that you don't really see at WWDC either.
So. Well, why do you think there's that disconnect? And why do you think young women are not attending WWDC and getting excited about app programming?
Well, there's just not that many women who are doing app development in any field, but certainly not for Macs and for iOS devices. So I wouldn't say that they're not getting, I mean, I would say yes, at some point the message is out there that computers are for boys. I think that's pretty well
established. Who sends those messages?
A lot of, you know, it comes from a lot of different directions, but certainly the gaming community doesn't help. That I think girls perceive computers as something that you sit and play games in your basement, you know,
in a kind of aggressive way with lots of death and blood and explosions.
Yes, I mean, certainly my impression, to be honest. So there's also, I'd have to look it up, but there was an article this year about how families bought computers for their boys, but not for their girls. Back 20 years ago. So when the first PCs were coming out, and this is certainly true in my experience, and my brother got a Mac, and he's 7 years younger than me. He got a Mac before I ever got a computer. So, I mean, it was his interest. He wanted it, and he pretty much wanted it for games, I think. But it's just a different, there's a difference in like the emphasis of, you know, what do you use this computer for and what can you do? And when, you know, then it's kind of becomes kind of a self-perpetuating situation if all girls see are only boys using computers and only men teaching or developing software, that they get the message like, I don't really fit in here. And certainly in the age group that App Camp for Girls is focused on, which is middle school age girls, that is not, you know, that is not very appealing to them to be the only girl in a class for most of them. You know, some girls don't mind and some women don't mind. And I certainly have been one of those women over the years. But I do mind now that it's systematic and it hasn't changed. It hasn't improved over the whole time that I've been working in technology-related things.
Well, you've done 9 or 10 of these app camps, right?
Right.
I'll bet you've seen that the young women that in your classes are just as capable of software programming as anybody else.
Yes, there's no doubt. They are, and they just haven't had somebody encouraging them or giving them a context or an environment where they felt comfortable to try something new.
I want to ask you a question.
Sure.
So my wife is a college professor and she teaches computer science, introduction to programming. She teaches people who are about 18 to 25, introductory Python, introductory C and C++. And her observation is that the young students in her classes who have the most difficulty with introduction to programming, especially through Python, is the ones who are not very experienced with mathematics in high school. Mm. They graduate from high school, they never took much math, and then all of a sudden they're looking around for something to do and they go, oh, I want to build games, I want to learn how to program. And programming is basically, in my mind, an instantiation of an algorithm. And that algorithm is expressed perhaps in algebra, in lower level mathematics, or expressed through code. But once you've studied mathematics, you're familiar with equations, algorithms, variables, loops, and things like that. And so when you move into programming, you see programming as just another way of manifesting an algorithm.
Right.
And it's very natural to you. What do you think?
I think there's a certain level of math that is important, and algebra is probably it, you know, that, I mean, I'm not a computer science professor and I'm not teaching the upper levels, so I can't speak to that. But I know in our discussions with App Camp about, App Camp doesn't have any prerequisites. We don't expect them to know anything about coding. That's not the idea.
Mm-hmm.
But we do have this age group that has mostly had algebra already. Because, as you say, variables and, you know, equations are important to understand that kind of theoretical relationships between.
That's right.
Okay, so that's important, and I agree with that. But I have also read interesting articles about how there's too much emphasis on saying, well, that you need to be good at math to be a good programmer. And I think that that may be holding back girls as well, because, again, they drop out of the math and science stuff pretty much around this age, and that's why another reason why we target middle school girls is that, you know, by the time they go to high school, the number of girls who say they're really interested in science or math like goes down, and they and if they don't feel confident in math, how are they going to feel confident in programming if all we do is talk about it like it's an extension of mathematics? So, you know, it doesn't require a graduate degree in mathematics for sure. I think algebra, I mean, it depends. I did calculus and multivariable calculus in college. That was like my last math class. And I can program. I don't choose to do it. I'm not focused on that right now, but I don't know how much math is really required. And I would love to actually, I'll find this article and send you the link. And I'd love to know what your wife thinks of it, because it was kind of eye-opening, because I sort of accepted as well that math is important for coding, and maybe it's not as important as we think.
Okay. I have another question for you.
Okay.
When we got our Apple IIs, the only way to approach the Apple II was with the programming language, like BASIC. Yes. And we sat there and we typed in games and we typed in Eliza, and we conversed with the Apple II through a programming language. But when Steve Jobs envisioned the Macintosh, he envisioned it as an appliance. And he had this whole new way of doing things with the desktop. And you pointed and you clicked and you had files and you had icons. And it didn't ship with a programming language. And ever since then, there's been that heritage from Apple. You know, you can buy a Mac, and deep, deep, deep down inside, if you know how to use it, there's Perl, Python, and Ruby. But there's no explicit programming language out of the box. And it's even more so with the iPad and the iPhone.
Right.
Do you think that the lack of a programming language that would be a security issue, and that's why Apple doesn't do it. But do you think that because the iPad and our iPhones don't have a programming language that people can play with, that's been harmful in some way? Or do you think it doesn't matter?
I think it matters for a certain, you know, small subset of the users. And as you say, like, lack of an obvious open programming environment on a device that people are getting, you know, it's going to discourage or not inspire the coders, as we understand it from the days when there wasn't a graphic user interface. Some cool things are coming out on the iPad for sure, and even on the iPhone, you know, that are coding related. I'm not that well versed in them, but there's a couple of coding programs on the iPad that kids are using. One is called Hopscotch, another one's called Codea. So,
send me links to that.
Yes, I will. And that can make coding maybe more enticing to the non super geeky kids who would, you know, say go into BASIC and, you know, write a game.
And there's a new one out. We just posted an article the other day about IBM's Swift sandbox that you can get to through a browser.
I played with that. Oh, my goodness. I got very excited about that.
Awesome.
But, you know, because one of the barriers to learning iOS development, and certainly for our campers, is that if they don't have a Mac and they don't have Xcode, they can't. And now I played with it a little bit when it came out, the Swift that environment, IBM's sandbox or whatever they called it for Swift, and it got me very excited, because I thought I could totally see writing some Swift tutorials that anybody could do now.
Do you think it might be something you would fold into App Camp for Girls, where they can then go off and continue their work?
Yes, I do. I think at least, you know, I mean, one of the things that we do that I think has been part of our success is that we do try to make the work fun and relevant, and think about what these kids would be interested in, and not just start with, you know, if-then statements and conditionals and loops. And I would like to approach the Swift, you know, teaching Swift from that perspective as well. And I know Apple is interested in teaching it from that perspective as well. They've put out tutorials now that are not starting with, you know, variables and functions and loops and conditionals.
So where does ZapCamp for Girls go from here? Are you thinking about expanding to different cities?
Well, we are right now, as of last summer, we were doing camps in Portland, Seattle, and Vancouver, British Columbia, so Canada. And we are officially a Canadian nonprofit as well. So we hope to expand in Canada. And this coming summer, 2016, we're going to add at least two more locations in still in the West, not ready to go off to the East Coast yet. Mm-hmm. I mean, because part of what is required for camp is a set of equipment, expensive equipment. And we have MacBook Pros and we have iPod Touches for the girls to use. And it's not a simple task. You know, we bought our set that we have now. You know, we can set everything up the same. All the computers are set up the same. The provisioning is all set up, you know, with Xcode and the developer account. It's not the kind of thing that you could say, oh, just get a bunch of computers together and you can do this.
Sure.
You know?
Sure. Well, I wish you good luck with that.
Thank you.
And I watched that video you showed me about CBS Innovation Nation. That must have been a thrill.
That was pretty exciting, yeah.
Yeah. Has that generated a lot of more national interest? Have you noticed?
Yes, we definitely got queries and emails. And the team that made that video, they were awesome. I really thought it was a good learning experience for the girls as well to have that kind of level of production crew come in and make something that's going to be broadcast, you know, national television broadcast worthy with just four people. And the producer was a woman and the on-air reporter was a woman, and they really relate it to the girls. Probably my favorite thing about it was that sometimes we had to do things twice or maybe even three times to get the shot that they wanted. And I said to them, remember this next time you're watching a reality show. that it's a good lesson to learn that television, the television you see on TV is the product of a lot of hard work and possibly, you know, many, many takes.
That's right. Tell us how people can contact you if they're interested in ZapCamp for Girls.
We are at on the line. On the line, sound like online. We are appcampforgirls.com, and the four is the numeral four, so appcampforgirls.com. And we're on Facebook at ZapCamp for Girls and Twitter, same thing. So we're in all those places, and I'm also on Twitter myself as MacGenie, MacGenie, and I'm pretty active on Twitter, and I do answer a lot of questions there as well. So that's a good place, actually, to get in touch with me, as good as email, I would say.
Excellent, excellent. Well, I think it's about time to wrap it up. I'm really pleased that you're doing this, and I want to thank you for being on the show.
Thanks so much for having me. It was really fun to talk to you.
It's been great. And listeners, I hope you enjoyed the show too. And thank you for coming by. We'll see you next time on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.